Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about pipelining, starting with reviewing it, since you probably forgot a little bit over the break, maybe. But first, some other things. So one logistical note, we discovered the week before spring break that there was a bug in HCL2D. This was one which was subtle enough to go unnoticed for several semesters, and we think it's unlikely it will break your processor. The form of the bug is that sometimes, but not always, register file writes would happen such that you could read the value you just wrote in the same cycle, which is not how the register file is supposed to work. It's supposed to be that it always waits until that rising edge of the clock, the end of the cycle, to do the write. And HCL2D didn't always implement that. So we have a new version which fixes this. The same thing also happened with memory writes, but you'd have to read and write memory in the same cycle, which at the same place, which the only way of doing is by having some reading from the instruction memory while writing to the data memory. So it's very unlikely you'd come across that. Generally, I think this bug would have helped your processor correctness, so we will gray with the old, more lenient version. But you probably should use the new one, since it's less confusing for register file writes to sometimes happen at one time and sometimes a different one. Any questions? Yeah.
So there's an update we should download?
Yeah, so just a new version, yeah. And we're grading with the more lenient version because I recognize that some people won't do that. But it will be better. So some people have asked for explanation of this last quiz question here. So about functional units. So in the reading, we talk about the more advanced form of processors that Samira will go over probably on Thursday, or not next week, where we had these functional units. And this table has an entry for issue time and latency, and it also had an entry for capacity. And this is, I think, the big thing which confused people. So an issue time of one cycle means after you send something to this functional unit, which does multiplication in this case, after you send something to multiply, you wait one cycle and you can send another thing. The latency means that after you send something to multiply, you wait three cycles and then you get your answer. And there's also a capacity. And some people thought the capacity is how many multiplies we can have going on at once. But if we can only have one multiply going on at once, it wouldn't make much sense for the issue time to be less than the latency. I can't think how that would work, because somehow we can issue the cycle afterwards, and yet if there's a capacity of one, but we haven't gotten the answer yet, that would be very confusing. But the capacity actually means it's how many each time you can do issuing, you can issue at the same time. A good way of thinking of what they call the capacity is something I would just usually call it copies of the functional unit. So if the table says that you have multiplication functional units with a capacity of 4, the way I think about that is that there are 4 multiplication units, each of one of which has the same issue time and same latency. And you use whichever one is available. So if you had a capacity of 4, you could do 2 multiplies in 3 cycles, because you'd issue to 2 of them and still have 2 left over. You have a capacity of 1, you can do it in 4 cycles, because you issue in the first cycle, get your answer 3 cycles later, then you issue in the next cycle and get your answer 3 cycles later. So the last one finishes after 1 plus 3 cycles. So questions about this? So we just finished introducing you to pipelining and how we dealt with control hazards in pipelining. And what we did with pipelining is the first thing we did is we took our stages that we were using to divide up our sequential single cycle processor, just for convenience sake, and made them real. And we did that by dividing them with pipeline registers. So now, instead of fetch, decode, execute being sort of divisions, but they actually happen in parallel, depending on just how things propagate down wires, now they're really divided, that we do a fetch for an instruction and send the results to a pipeline register, where they wait until the next cycle. So we actually do this step by step in these steps. And that's by adding those pipeline registers to separate each step of the computation for instructions. And this allows us to get, ideally, 5 instructions executing at any one time. We can't always do that, as it turns out, because of hazards. But the ideal is that we're writing back one instruction while doing the memory phase of another, doing the execute of another, and so on. And one thing we have to adjust for this with control hazards was how we dealt with the PC. We can't do the thing where we consider the PC update the last stage, because if we do that, then we can't actually keep this pipeline full. We can't move an instruction to decode and have something to fetch. So we needed to do our PC update typically in the fetch stage. So we had something to fetch the next cycle, so we knew what to fetch. And for normal cases, we just move the logic to the fetch. But this didn't always work. We had 2 important cases where we couldn't look at the output of the instruction memory in the old PC and figure out what are we doing next. And one of them was conditional jumps. And we could have just stalled for conditional jumps, but we had this better and, in fact, easier to implement solution, which was branch prediction. So for conditional jumps, we make a guess. And the guess our textbook has chosen is that we assume it's always taken. That we look at the destination address in the instruction and always go there. And later on, when the jump gets to execute, where it actually figures out, should this jump have happened, we verify our guess. If we verify it as correct, we do nothing. We're done. We did the right thing the first time in our guess, and we have nothing more to do. But if it's wrong, we need to fix up what's in the pipeline. We need to get rid of the instructions that we mistakenly guessed would happen that didn't. So that was for conditional jumps. The other tricky case we had was return. And in return, we couldn't guess. We didn't have a way of getting a reasonable guess. I mean, we could make a guess. We could like assume the return goes to the next instruction, but that's usually wrong. Doesn't make sense to do that. So instead, we just stalled. So rather, when we have a return, we don't fetch the next thing. We just stay where we are, and we wait until the return advances down this pipeline to the memory stage. And when it gets there, then we can know what to fetch. So we had stalling for the return. And both of these ways of handling control hazards meant that our pipeline was slower than the ideal of 5 instructions at a time, finishing 1 instruction per cycle. So the ideal pipeline processor is going to give us that every cycle we finish 1 instruction. But because we have branch mispredictions where we waste 2 cycles and returns where we waste 3 or 4 cycles, we have something that's slower than that. That for a typical program, which contains more than 1 return and more than 1 branch we can't predict, the average execution speed is going to be, per instruction, is going to be greater than 1 cycle per instruction. And as we discussed with more complicated pipeline designs, this is a reason the depth of the pipeline matters, the latency to do something. Because the amount of stalling, the amount of instructions we did wrong, is based on how deep our pipeline is. And this was a reason something like the Pentium 4, which tried to have a very deep pipeline, ended up not being that much faster because of it. They had a very deep pipeline, so even though the ideal speed that they could execute programs was much faster, in practice it was often not any faster because of these penalties that scaled up higher with the pipeline depth. Okay, so first thing we're going to go over is we're going to look at the logic for implementing these control hazard handling. So we have these two sorts of things we do to our pipeline registers. So one thing is what our book calls, and what HCLTD is going to call, stalling. Is that we sometimes take the value that the register is outputting and give it as input. So conceptually, stalling means don't change the current register. I know you have some input here, ignore it. So that's what we call stalling a pipeline register. And we have this other control signal called bubbling, where we say, okay, whatever you're inputting there, I don't care about it. I just want a NOP, the default value. That's what you should put in this register. So whenever we have this bubble signal, we ignore whatever's coming in that would normally go in the register in normal pipeline execution and replace it with a NOP. And these exist as first-class entities in HCLTD. So HCLTD provides all these muxes for you for everything in every register bank and gives you these control signals for it. So if a register bank is lowercase a, uppercase b, so uppercase b is the output, we have signals named after the output which control this stall and bubble behavior. So if you set the stall signal to 1, then it's going to keep the old value. It's going to ignore what's coming in on the A signals, and it's going to use whatever's being output now as the output in the next cycle. You have the bubble signal, where we're going to ignore what's coming in on the A signals and use whatever the default value you declared when you defined the registers was. And if you want the bubble signal to be useful, that better correspond to a NOOP. So this is a common point of confusion. So any questions on this? Yeah?
I feel like the way the book described it, it said that you stall by inserting a bubble.
So the act of stalling is going to involve both of these control signals. Because when we stall, we'll go through this later today. So when we stall, for example, in return, we want the PC not to advance. So that's going to be stalling. We also want the thing after the fetch stage to execute a NOOP and not another copy of return. And that's going to be bubble. So we're going to do both. So we're going to need bubble to fix up the things we're missing because of our stall. Yes?
So you really only ever use the stall mode for the fetch register?
So the question is, we really only use stall for fetch? That's not true because we could stall later. So we could, for example, stall fetch and decode. So we could leave those where they are and let other things advance. I don't think we'll have a case, we might have a case later on where it would be okay to do this. You don't have to, but that's an option you have, is that you could decide to stall after we let an instruction get to decode or something like that, in which case we'll need to stall both decode and fetch. Okay, so other questions? So since there are no more questions, so here's an exercise. So please take out paper or something to write on, type on, whatever, and fill out this table. So what this is showing is that at time 0, the input to A value is 1. The output of the register is FF because it's the first cycle, so it's outputting the default value. And the input to stall is 0, and the input to bubble is 0. And you should fill in what's going to happen in the next cycle to the output of this register. And the first case is simple. We have an input of 0 and an input of 0 to stall and bubble. So the register behaves normally, which means it takes the value it has as input in the previous cycle, which is 1, and puts it in its output. And it doesn't matter that there's a stall in the next cycle because we haven't gotten there yet when we're deciding what the output's going to be at time 1. So I want you to fill out the rest of this table, and when you've done that, compare with a neighbor and see if you both agree. Thank you. And since I asked you to compare with the neighbor, you are allowed to talk. I don't expect you to do that silently. For everything. So a reasonable number of people. So I have the answers, which hopefully are correct. At least no one in the last section noticed any problems. Basic idea is if we did not, if stall and bubble were always zero, then we'd always copy the input in one cycle to the output in the next cycle. So one, and times 0 to 1. And that's what we're going to do when they're both 0. So for example, here at time 4, they're both 0. So we copy the 5 to the output. And time 5, they're both 0, so we copy the 6 to the output in the next cycle. When we stall, we ignore the input and copy the current output to the as the output in the next cycle. It's like we don't have a rising edge of the clock. We ignore the rising edge of the clock when the stall signal is set. So here we're outputting 1, the stall signal is set, so we keep outputting 1. We don't change anything. So we stop having the register change anything. When we bubble, we ignore the input here, and we output the default value, which is in this declaration up here. And if you want bubble to do the operation of inserting a knob, this value better correspond to what you expect in a knob. So any questions on any of this confusion? Yes.
Yes, so for the A value 0x02, well, is there a way in the future after you've stalled one cycle for that ever to be written to the B value?
So the question is, yeah, so we have A value 2 here, and we stalled, and the value seems to be lost. And yeah, it will be lost because the thing that was feeding A wasn't also stopped. So if you want to do a stall after the first stage of the pipeline, you better have everything before it's stalling, or else you'll get exactly that bug where you'll lose a value. Like setting the stall signal, it just changes the behavior of this register. It doesn't deal with its input. Other questions? Okay, so these are the signals we can use to conveniently implement things like the stall we're supposed to do on rect. So I'm going to show how we're going to set these registers on this diagram here, where I'm going to say fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, the stages of our instruction, and I'm going to draw lines representing our register banks. And we have one special case, which is the line from fetch to fetch. This actually represents the PC. So it doesn't contain the call instruction stuff. It contains the stuff for the instruction that would be naturally after call. And I'm going to mark each of these lines with, that should be a B, with stall, bubble, or normal. So normal means neither of them are set, and we just advance as usual. So for diagonal lines, that means we take the instruction there and move it on, just like we would normally. For the line from fetch to fetch, that means we fetch the next instruction normally. So when we're implementing the stall for ret, we have this call beforehand. The call is just going to advance all the way down here. So all these diagonal lines that cover the call instruction are going to be marked N. We're not going to stall and bubble. We want the call instruction to go through normally. And the same thing is true of the ret that we actually execute, the ret that's actually responsible for accessing memory. That's going to all go through normally. Doesn't matter that we're stalling. We don't want the thing which actually does the memory operation not to get to memory. So this diagonal line is all going to be normal. But we're going to want to do something special in fetch. And I've marked this as stalling in fetch. We don't technically need to do that because as long as we don't use the PC we fetch, it doesn't matter that we're fetching things we don't need. But usually we would stall to avoid having the instruction memory do random weird work. And the important case is what we do later. So here, this is the cycle we read ret. We don't want to go to a new instruction, so we stall the PC. After that, ret is in the decode stage, and we're still waiting for it to finish. And we have to send something to the decode stage. And if we do the natural thing, we're going to send ret or some other instruction to the decode stage. We want to send a knob. And since we want nothing here, that means the line coming into it better have a bubble. That's because we know I want nothing in the decode stage at time 3. There better be a bubble going into it. So how about for the next stage? So we're going to stall the PC again, and we're going to bubble from fetch to decode, because we want nothing there, not whatever we fetched at red. We don't want you to put another red in there or some other instruction. How about here? Do I need a bubble? So why not?
Because it's just like a no op. I can
help. Yeah, so I don't need a bubble here, but I could put one. Either is correct, but the simpler thing to implement is going to be to just do the normal thing. And we can do that because we know we have nothing here. And if we just let that no op propagate like a normal instruction, everything's going to work fine. It wouldn't be wrong to bubble here, but it's not necessary. And it's more HCL to decode. So eventually, we actually get the address from memory for RET. And this gets communicated back to the fetch stage. At that point, we don't want to stall the fetch. We want to advance normally. So we aren't going to do anything funny. But we still need to bubble into the code. Even though we're done, we know we're done at this point. That doesn't mean that we have the instruction ready. So we still need a bubble here. And this is the set of control signals we need to implement the RET. So my recommendation when you need to figure out how to implement stalls and bubbles and things like that is to go through a picture like this to figure out what should I be setting these control signals to. And you can translate this into the actual HCL to decode you're going to use. So for example, to do the bubbling for a RET, we want to sometimes, while we're waiting for the RET, in the cycles we're waiting for the RET, each of these three cycles, we want to send a bubble signal. And then we can detect we're in one of those cycles by looking at where the RET instruction that we're actually running is. And if it's in any of the stages that indicate it's not done yet, we know we need a bubble. And given that, we can set the bubble signal for the decode stage. And similarly, we can set the stall signal for the PC register if we care about keeping the PC from advancing while we're waiting for a RET. Doesn't matter so much because we'll replace the PC with whatever we read. In which case, we do some similar logic to say, did we just fetch a RET, or do we have a RET that's waiting that's not going to be finished yet? And if it's stalled, And if we need the stall, we set the stall signal for our PC register appropriate. So an alternate way we can look at this, and I want to show you these pictures because this is sort of the pictures our textbook uses, and we'll find it more useful for one of our next topics, is that we can, instead of drawing the timeline with time going down and showing you what's in each phase at each time, directly we can sort of give this sort of diagram where we show the progression of instructions through phases. And conceptually, we have the add queue after RET, but we stall for a bunch of cycles because we can't finish the fetch for add queue. We don't know enough yet. So we're stalling in fetch. This is a way of representing the same thing which happened there. I don't think this form is as useful for figuring out how to implement the stalling and bubbling, because you can't like directly see from this that, oh, I need a bubble signal out of decode. But we'll find this more useful later on for figuring out other things about hazards in our pipeline. So any questions on this picture? Okay. So that was stalling. That was one of the things we could do with these stall and bubble signals. And we can also implement the squashing that we need for conditional jumps. So when we have a conditional jump and find out, oh, I fetched an add and an RM move queue, and oops, I didn't want to do that, and we want to replace them with nothing, how do we do that? So here, I have a jump. I compute whether the jump is taken by reading the condition codes that were possibly just set in the previous cycle. And I, based on that, I find out, oh, I don't actually want to have anything in decode and execute. Yeah?
Bubbles.
So this is exactly what the bubble signal does. If we set the bubble signal going from this R move queue to where it would go normally. We'll ignore that R move queue value and replace it with nothing. So we're going to use bubble signals as how we implement the squashing, the handling of mixed prediction. So this is the extra work we're going to do in the case where we mispredict a jump. How about if when we don't? What are our signals then? Or how about before here? Do we need to do anything special? So people are shaking their head. So we're just going to advance the program counter normally. That normal advancement better use the destination address, or policy is that we assume the jump is taken. But we're just advancing all the instructions normally. And if our prediction was correct, we're in fact going to do everything normally. There's nothing special with these bubble install signals. It's only in the case where we made a mistake and need to fix it. And the way we're going to fix it is by setting these two bubble signals to get rid of these two instructions we shouldn't have started. So the logic for that in HTLTD is going to be that we're going to say, OK, are we executing a jump? And you have to write the code to figure out whether, based on the condition codes, it was supposed to be taken. But if it was, then you set the bubble signals based on whether that misprediction happened. And we can also view this in the alternate way, except I shouldn't have this D here, probably. As sort of what's happening. There shouldn't be a D here, but you know, so we started this add instruction and didn't finish it. We started this MRR move queue instruction and didn't get to finish it. And that's this other picture of what's happening in the pipeline. Yeah.
Sorry, can you explain why you didn't finish it?
Didn't what?
Like why did you decide to not finish your add queue?
Because this was because we predicted that this jump would be taken, okay. And it wasn't. And we, in fact, wanted to go to the next instruction, which happened to be XOR. So what I've told you are the basic things you want to do with jump install. So one thing I'd like to go over is, let's say instead of having an add queue here, we had a rect. So if I had a rect instead of an add queue, what am I going to be doing here in place of this R move queue? Can I do the R move queue? So what do we do on ret when we run a ret normally? So people stall. Yes, that's what people are saying. So is that going to be different when we're running a ret that's part of a predicted branch, like this, where this add queue instruction is? So no, because in the case where our prediction is right, we want everything to happen normally. So that means that we're going to stall here if we had a ret. So if this was a ret, this would be waiting. We wouldn't go to the instruction after the ret, because we're not going to execute that anyways, even in rets, that's not where the ret's going. And we put the ret here. And we want to squash the ret. So if we had a ret in stage 4 in decode, we wouldn't want it to get to execute. That would be bad. And we also really want to get to this XOR. We don't want to keep waiting for the ret. So when you implement your pipeline processor, you're going to need to handle things like, what if I have two situations where I need to do stalling and squashing at the same time, and make sure the appropriate things take priority. So if this is a ret here, when you squash the ret, it better be the case that you're actually executing the correct next instruction, that you don't for some reason decide that I need to keep waiting at the ret. That make any questions on that? So, never mind. Here's another exercise. So now, instead of figuring out mechanically what stalling and bubbling does, now that you maybe know that, let's say, how do I make this sort of situation happen? So I have an instruction E in fetch, and I want to stall in fetch on that instruction. And I have an instruction D in decode that I want to get rid of, that I want to squash. At the same time, I want to stall and execute. I have an instruction C that I can't advance from execute for some reason. It's waiting for something. So I want it to stay in execute, which means that I don't have anything to put in the memory stage. But with the instruction in memory, it can actually finish. So it's going to go to write back. So I want you to write down what you think all the control signals for the stall and bubble should be for this. And when you're done, compare your answer with the neighbor to make sure both agree. Okay, who has all of them written down? Who doesn't? A couple of people. Okay. Wait another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so my answers are that I want to, in fetch, I want to fetch the same thing again, so I want the PC to be the same, so I'm going to stall. In decode, from fetch to decode, I want to bubble. I don't want to send E to decode, I want to send a NOT, so I want to bubble to replace that E I would send with a NOT. In execute, I don't want to send D to execute. In fact, I want to stall to keep the old thing, the C, that I already had in execute. In memory, I don't want to send C to memory because it's being kept in execute, so I'm going to bubble to have something to put in memory that does nothing. And in writeback, we actually advance B as usual from memory to writeback, so that's going to be normal. So any questions about this? Note that this is very typical of exam questions we've asked in the past in this class, so we expect you to know how to do this. Okay, so,
why is the write list one N is going to go from B to B?
Yeah, so B to B.
Right.
It's the same instruct. We actually advance the instruction along the line, therefore it's normal.
Okay.
We're doing what we would do if we didn't have any sort of hazards or anything like that.
Okay.
That's always the normal case. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit confused. So which one do we need to squash in this case and why?
So squashing means we're getting rid of instructions we've started. And this diagram is showing us squashing D, because D appears up here, and it's not done, and it doesn't appear here. So it must have been squashed. And this is an illustration that squashing doesn't always mean bubbling, because in this case we're squashing by stalling in the next cycle, because that happens to get rid of the instruction. It just doesn't replace it with a knob, it replaces it with what was there previously, which we're keeping there. And D is squashed, and C is stalled, and E is stalled, and A actually gets to complete. Okay, other questions? Okay, so assuming everyone has a reasonable understanding of stall and bubble, we're going to talk about data hazards. So now that we've talked all about how you do stalling and bubbling, you could have you implement that to handle all data hazards and only stall when you needed to for data hazards. But it's very unsatisfying. A lot of programs you write, like compute on a value in a register in one instruction and then use that value that you just computed in the next instruction. And a lot of programs our compilers generate do that. And it would sure be really annoying if we had to add two extra cycles each time we did that. And in fact, we're going to have a better way. And the observation we're going to make is that we have the value before it would be needed. So if you look here, this is our old pipeline add queue processor example of a data hazard. So here, we've not done any stalling, and we just send these through, and we read 900 for R9, for our second instruction, while we have waiting over here 1700, the value that's supposed to be in that register, but isn't there yet. But it's somewhere in our processor. We already have computed it. So wouldn't it be nice if we could just use this value here that we've already computed, that's right here, instead of the value we're putting in there? And in fact, that's what we're going to do. We're going to add the appropriate wire to move a value from here to here to, from here to here, to make that happen. And we're not just going to add a wire to communicate that value unconditionally, because we don't always use R9 the same at register we used before. So we're going to have a mux to control whether we use that shortcut. So we're going to take our old processor. We're going to observe that, okay, when we're executing this, we have R8 and R9 for the first instruction, while we have the register numbers here. And then we have our new value in here, while we have the old value up here. And our fix is going to be that we're going to add that wire. We're going to take the value on this wire that's being input to that register and use it instead of what we get from the register file. And we're not going to always do that, because some instructions don't use the same register that the previous instruction used. So we're going to have a mux here to decide when we want this value instead of the value in the register. And this can also happen in the other way. We could write to R9 and then read from R9 using RB. So we're going to do the same thing for source B. And apologies for the extra line here. This should come from before. So the basic idea is that when we would read a wrong value, we already have the correct value somewhere when we want to use that wrong value, and it's available before we actually need to use the value we read from the register file. So we're going to substitute whatever you read from the register file with a copy of that correct value from elsewhere in the pipeline. And we're just going to add a whole bunch of wires all around our processor to do that, and mux is to decide when we use those extra wires. So an important question is, well, how do these muxes work? So when do we take, for example, this path here, where we take the value that's being about to be set, put in a register and use it as the source A input? And basically, the idea is going to be that we sometimes set this register value to the output of the register file. That's our normal case. But we have some other case where we use the input to this register. So what's the correct condition here? One of these answers is probably correct, especially since E is something else. Are there any volunteers for what? So think of what you think the correct condition is and see if your neighbor agrees. After that, you can see if anyone's brave enough to volunteer their answer. Has an answer to volunteer who thinks they know what which of these should be. No one? So what we want to compare, as they suggest, register numbers. We want to look for is, well, is the register we're reading in the instruction that's in decode, that register, you know, since the mux is in decode, the register that we're reading for decode, is that the one that is the same as the one that would be put in val-e, for an eval-e? So eval-e is from the execute stage, and we want to find the register number that corresponds to that. And that register number is the register number that's on this thin wire here, going to that other pipeline register, which is dest e, the dest e that we put into the register file. So that means we want c here. We want to say, is the value here the same as what we put in for source a? And if it is, then we can take this shortcut. We know that we're actually going to write this value to the register file later. So if we were doing these instructions one at a time, that's what we should have been reading. And so we actually want to take the shortcut. Sorry?
Should it be a double equal?
It should be a double equal, yes. How about that? So the answer is technically E, okay. yes, it should be a double equal to have correct HCL syntax. I'm pretty sure you can't do an assignment in a mux. I hope not. So that's the idea, is that we're going to compare the register number that should be on that wire to the register number we're expecting to have, which we can get from source A. We could also get it from other places. And we have the same sort of problem here, so because we could also use RP to read the thing that we just modified, which hasn't made it to the register file yet. So I note that we're showing you one way of doing forwarding. You can also do it afterwards. Our textbook doesn't do this, but this is a perfectly valid and correct option. It's that you could have a mux on the output of the registers and always use the output of that mux. Our textbook does this instead. Whichever you find easier to understand is okay. They're both real things that you can do. So if we have this picture, let's talk generally about when we do forwarding. And the reason I showed you this picture, this type of picture of instructions executing earlier, is that this picture is much better for figuring out how forwarding is supposed to happen, because it emphasizes what's happening at the same time. So what we're going to do is we're going to look for data dependencies. So you should be able to figure out where are there data dependencies here. So what's the first data dependency you see? R9. So R9 is written in the add queue and read by the sub queue. So that means that we're computing a value in execute of R9 of add queue and using it in execute of sub queue. And that's where we're going to need forwarding. So we need to take whatever we get from execute and have it available, execute in add queue and have it available for the execute of sub queue. And you notice that this line goes forwards. If this line went backwards, we'd have a problem because we can't use the value we haven't computed yet. But fortunately, it goes forwards, so we can do forwarding and not have any delays. As long as we send this signal here, it won't matter that this add queue doesn't write the value until right back here, and the value isn't read until the code, which ordinarily would be a problem. So, yeah.
So the arrow is going between
D and E. The arrow here is going, it's from the end of execute and add queue to the end of decode and sub queue.
Okay. So it's like for the execute of the second instruction.
Yeah, so it's available in time for the execute of the second instruction. And if you're doing forwarding after the registers, like that alternative, I would probably draw it after this dotted line. But it's the same thing, it still works. The important thing is that we know we have the value by this time available, and we just need to make sure it's sent because it's not going to be sent through the register file. So let's look at our, so we have this alternative we could do, it works the same. So there's another dependency with R9. Which is that this write back finishes after cycle 4, and we need the value a little earlier, so that's another forwarding we need to do. Because if we just waited, the write back would finish and the value would be stored in cycle 5, which is not when we're trying to read it for this rmove queue. So in fact, we need to do this forwarding. We don't need the value until memory, but we can't actually forward later because we don't have the instruction anymore. So any other data dependencies see here? So R11, that's the next obvious example. So the subtract goes into R11 and goes into MR move queue. So when do we need this value, this R11 in MR move queue? Is it execute memory decode? When do we actually use it? So people are saying memory is when we use this R11 value. And execute. So someone wants to defend execute? Yeah.
Do you have to add 4 to it?
Because we have to add 4 to it. So even though the MR move queue instruct operation doesn't do anything conceptually until memory, like doesn't do anything useful, really, but it needs to compute the address and that happens in execute, which means we need R11 in execute. So we're gonna forward just like before to the end of decode, so it's available in time for execute. We can't wait because the execute is where that address computation happens. Doesn't matter that it's a memory operation, this is not the thing we use in the memory stage. It's the thing we need in the execute stage. So there's another dependency here, which is that this R11 value is also used for the address of the RM move queue. So that means that we need this value as input before the execute stage, which means we're going to forward from the memory stage of the subtraction function to just to the end of the decode stage in RM move queue. So it doesn't matter that the subtract instruction isn't doing anything in the memory stage. We're still passing the values through that stage, and we have a case where we actually need to use that value in order to forward it appropriately. Or do it later and write back. Well, sorry, no, memory, yeah. For R9, we do it later because it's needed in memory. We could do it later. So we do forwarding, and we look at the diagram and you figure out when can you do forwarding. You can't forward from execute to here because then your forwarding path needs to go through a register because it crosses a cycle boundary. So we're always going to forward in the same cycle. And that's how you decide what forwarding paths you need to implement. And the usual procedure is that you're going to look at when you need the value, where could it be? And let's enumerate all those possibilities about where it could be and see if the register numbers match. So we have one more dependency here, which is this R10 we read from memory to this XOR. And it turns out we can do forwarding for that. And we need to forward from memory because the value isn't available until then. So there's no way we can forward from after execute because we wouldn't have the value to forward. So this is the logical forwarding path to implement. And given this, it seems like we can actually solve most of our data hazards. So this code has a ton of data hazards all over the place. And yet, with forwarding, we can resolve all of those hazards with no stalling whatsoever. And in almost all cases, we're going to fix data hazards this way. But there's one problem that we're not quite able to solve with forwarding, where we just don't have the value early enough. And you notice that the general pattern here is that for things which need the value in execute, it's sufficient for the previous instruction to have the value at the end of its execute stage. There's no delay there. But we have this weird case here where we get the value in memory, in which case we need to wait an instruction ahead. So if we say compute a value in memory and then need it right away and execute, that's going to be not good enough. We have the value at the end of memory. If we try to forward it, it's too late. We needed it earlier. So what we're going to have to still do for this case, and this was what our textbook calls the load use hazard. We load a value from memory and then immediately use it, is we're going to need to stall. And here I'm showing stalling in the fetch stage. You could stall in the decode stage as long as you handle all the stall and bubble signals correctly. So we're still going to use forwarding in this case where we're stalling. Because by using forwarding, we've made the stall much, much shorter than it would otherwise be. We have to wait a couple more cycles at least in order to get to write back and have that finish. By forwarding, we're still saving time, but we don't eliminate all stalls. And this is the one kind of data hazard that we still can't handle with forwarding. Every other data hazard we are actually going to handle without any delays. So this wouldn't be true if our pipeline was more complicated, but this is an advantage of this sort of fetch, decode, execute memory, like this five-stage pipeline, which is very similar to the pipeline of early RISC processors, which were designed that way for a reason. This is basically what the original MIPS processor pipeline looked like, and they chose that design because it let them do that, because it basically made it so there were very few cases where they needed to stall. Okay. So as I said before, our forwarding logic is that we're going to have these muxes on, if you follow the textbook strategy, the inputs to registers that store to pipeline registers that store values that represent register values. And usually you're going to get the natural value, Like, for example, in the decode stage, the thing you got from the register file, in the execute stage, the thing you got from the ALU or from forwarded from the previous, from the decode stage from a register. So the natural value for the instruction. Or alternatively, you're going to have these other cases where you say, oh, I have a value that is from another stage, which is operating, which is ahead of me. So an instruction earlier in the program that's operating on that register and handling the same register number, and I need its value because it's more up to date than what I read in the register file. And one thing to note, and reason why this is a source of pain for people, is that if you don't enumerate all these cases, you're going to have a weird bug. There's going to be some instruction sequences where forwarding is needed, and you missed one case where you needed to forward, and you're going to get the wrong answer. And many of you will have this problem in some version of your processor. Hopefully you will figure it out before submitting it. So something to note about forwarding in general is that sometimes we have multiple options for forwarding. This is another difficulty in implementing it. So here, I could say I'm using R8 here and here, so I can forward it, right? Like, this is a value of R8, which is more up to date than the register file, so I can just forward it from the memory stage here in place of what I read from the register file, and that's good. You know, I got a more up-to-date version, but it's not the right version because the instruction in between updates it. So we have two options for getting a value of R8, and we better choose the more recent one. This is something that when you implement forwarding, you have to watch out for. You have to know that, yep, I'm choosing the correct version of the value when I have multiple options. I'm choosing the most recent one in the pipeline. And generally in HCLTD, this means that you probably will just order your mucks correctly because it will take the first option. That's why our muxes do that. And make sure that the first option is this previous add instruction and not the one before it. And of course, you can also have to do forwarding for multiple instructions legitimately. So in this case, we have R8 and R12. They both need to be forwarded to this app. They're separate registers, so that's going to work out perfectly normally. So any questions on how the code is forwarding? So the implementation for this case, yeah, is just about ordering your mucks correctly. That you want to use the least advanced instruction preferably, because that's the most up-to-date version of the value. And you should probably think of actually testing this case. Yes?
Yeah, so in actual CPU implementation, do we need to consider all the paths of forwarding? So will it be very messy? Because you just added wires based on the specific instructions.
So your question is the wiring very messy for this?
Yeah.
So yes, forwarding paths are a challenge both to wire and to just write when you're people are professionally producing CPUs, especially since they get worse when you have more than 5 pipeline stages, for example, or more complicated instructions, which like have 3 registers to 2, things like that. So yes, it is a challenge, but it is worth it. So sort of on the cost of forwarding issue, like what we're adding is we're adding this wire that might be awkward to place, but it's not doesn't take much time for a signal to go down the wire. And we're adding a mux, which is pretty fast compared to a register file or an adder or a multiplier or memory. So the total cost of forwarding is not very high. Yes, we are actually making our cycle time longer, But we got rid of, like, you know, if you look at this example here, we got rid of like probably like 10 cycles of stalling for a five instructions. You know, we made our processor, you know, if we made the cycle time 10% longer, we're probably perfectly happy with that because we made most programs execute like in half the number of cycles. So it's a net win, despite all the complexity. Okay. Another thing I'd like to note is that we sort of, all the forwarding we showed sort of had forwarding from to the end of decode, which is the most common case because you just write a register from the register file and you're going to use an up-to-date version. And usually you use that value right away. But there's one exception to this where we can still do forwarding. So here we have R8, which we, that should be an RM move queue, which we read from memory, then write to memory. And we can do forwarding for that. But the value is not available until after this memory stage, and we're forwarding into the memory stage of the next instruction. This is the forwarding path we still need to implement. We can't forward to decode because that would be going back in time. And there's no reason to stall between loading a value from memory and storing because we can actually do it with forwarding without stalling. And we're not going to do that. And note that we can have to forward, therefore, to multiple places, and that's fine. So we can end up using this value in three different places in our pipeline. So after we've implemented forwarding, we're left with, you know, pretty much nothing. We're left with, you know, only a few cases where we need to stall. So the only case we care about is the load use hazard and those control hazards. So we have RET. We need to stall for that. We haven't fixed that. And we have memory output that we need in the execute stage. This doesn't mean memory followed by non-memory, because, for example, push might need the memory output if we're writing into RSP. There are other cases where, and computing an address might need a memory output from a previous instruction. But those are the remaining cases where we need to stall. So that's all I have for today. So in the interest of keeping synced up with the other section.